This is Pottery 360, and we have an opportunity today to talk to somebody that I grew up reading when I was a kid, who obviously was a kid reading because we're about the same age. And I really want to thank you for your time. This is Barry Bloom. Welcome to Pottery 360. Barry, hope everything's going well out there in Peoria. What's it look like today?
It's a gorgeous day. I mean, and you really dated me, Wayne. So thanks a lot for the way you started that one off.
Well,
but yeah, it's like spring training weather here already. It's 80 degrees.
Well, the pictures you put up the other day looked really, really beautiful, and I'm looking forward to going out there for spring training.
Yeah, well, we've got the Nippon Ham Fighters out there, and they're going through the motions. They played a game against the Lotte Giants from the Korean League yesterday. You wouldn't have known that it was a early spring game, the way both teams played with intensity. And when Korea won the game in the ninth inning, their whole bench just exploded. So it was a big thing. It's interesting to always watch the Asians play.
That's definitely different from our spring trainings, because usually if somebody wins it in the ninth, it's like, okay, well, good, we're heading to the golf course right now.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, but this is grudge match between Korea and Japan.
Let's start off, Barry. I was trying to do some research, and I was curious, where did you grow up, and what sports did you follow when you were a kid?
I grew up in New York, in the Bronx, born in Manhattan, moved to the Bronx when I was about 10 years old. My father took me to my first Yankee game at what I call the original Yankee Stadium in 1960 against the Cleveland Indians. He said that I never took my eyes off the scoreboard. In 61 or 62, a friend's father took me to the old Madison Square Garden down by the ice for a Red Wing Ranger game.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my first experience of that. And both sports really sucked me in. I mean, I thought, I'm one of these guys, and there are a lot of people like me. I mean, if you give me a baseball game and a hockey game every other day, you know, I'm just very happy. I mean, there are hockey guys, I mean, I've covered the sport. There are hockey guys like Ken Holland, who's the general manager, longtime general manager of the Red Wings. Every time I see him, he doesn't want to talk about hockey, he wants to talk about baseball. You know, Gretzky played baseball. Tom Glavine played hockey.
Interesting.
I'm going to Vancouver Coyotes game tomorrow night, and I'm taking Danny Evans, the former Dodger GM, who's now scout for the Blue Jays, and I'm taking him. He's a hockey nut. I mean, it just seems like the sports cross over a lot. I'm not sure why, but you know, football, fine. Basketball, you know, I had my errors with, but. Mm-hmm. Really, hockey and baseball was really my root sports as I grew up, and really still are.
Well, then, you saying that, who's your all-time favorite hockey guy and your all-time baseball guy?
Well, hockey is pretty simple. I mean, even though I'm a lifetime Ranger fan, my favorite hockey player is Bobby Orr. I never saw anybody who was any better than Bobby Orr. He was a defenseman, and for those people who don't know the game, he played because a defenseman plays on the back blue line and towards the goal. He actually revolutionized the game by playing the whole ice. They used to play on a smaller ice surface in the old building in Boston, and it always seemed like with like two strides, he was back down at the other end of the ice. And when he'd make a rush on goal, then he was back the other way defending. And he actually led the NHL in points one year as a defenseman. So he's my top hockey player, you know, and baseball, you know, this is no, you know, slight at Willie Mays or Hank Aaron, because, you know, when I grew up, I never saw them play much. I mean, there was no national TV. They were, you know, not in New York. You know, Willie was already out on the West Coast. Aaron was either in Milwaukee or then obviously finishing his career mostly in Atlanta. but the three best players I ever saw and I'm privileged to have seen were Mantle in New York, who I grew up idolizing like a lot of people, and Gwynn in San Diego, who I covered from his first hit to his last hit, and Barry Bonds, who I think is the best all-around player I ever saw. So those three players, the fact that I got to spend so much time around them, either watching them or spending time with them and getting to know them, really have been a great thing in my life and my career.
That's a tremendous blessing, especially those three guys. You can't really go wrong. I know people dislike Bonds, but you know that's probably one of the better swings that you'll ever see an athlete or a baseball player, should say, have. I mean, tremendous, tremendous swing, just smooth, compact, and just tremendous power.
Well, I mean, Giants fans don't hate Bonds. And if you played, I often said, if he played for the Padres or played for the Dodgers, those fans would have loved him.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Bonds was just like mostly Ted Williams in his era, where beloved in Boston, but really despised everywhere else because of the type of attitude he had and the type of player he was, but mostly attitude. And, you know, Bonds fed off that attitude to make himself a better player. So, yeah, I, you know, totally agree.
Well, you mentioned about 1982, and that's, of course, that's the time you got hired by the Union Tribune, which is really ironic because, you know, that's the time, roughly 82, is when Gwynn got called up to the Padres. What was, at that time, I remember the Padres, that was really McKeon coming in and starting to rebuild the organization, or build the organization, I should say. What was the attitude of the club back at that point in time when you first started writing for the Padres?
Essentially, they'd gone through, you know, by 82, the first 13 years of the organization, from one manager to another, from one player to another, a couple of different ownerships, almost left town in 74, I think it was, to go to Washington, D.C., and only the, you know, National League stopped them from doing it. By 82, with bringing in Dick Williams to manage the team, you know, here was a guy who could manage, who had a name, who had won a pennant in Boston, championship in Oakland, had come close in Montreal until he was fired there. And I think that was, you know, start of the whole, you know, building block. And then, of course, the 81 draft, where, you know, probably sadly, the only really decent draft in Padre history, and obviously their best draft, drafting Kevin McReynolds in the first round and Gwynn in the third, and very almost Padre-esque in the way that they almost lost Gwynn because, you know, some people prevailed on McKeon to take a pitcher in the second round who never went anywhere, hoping that he would be around for the third round. And Houston wanted to draft Gwynn, and had Houston had a second-round pick that year, they would have drafted. But as it turned out, Houston had the pick behind the Padres in the third round, and the Padres didn't miss out on Gwynn. And basically, McKeon told his people, all right, I'll go with you on this for number two, but in the third round, we're taking Gwynn, and that's that. So, you know, that turned out to be the building blocks of, you know, their future for the 80s. And, you know, you had Garvey free agency in 83 and Gossage in 84 and Nettles in a trade with the Yankees right before the 84 season. But the thing about, which really teased me off the most about that era in Padre history is just, you know, really what it could have been. Because, I mean, they let Winfield go to free agency. They traded Ozzie Smith for Gary Templeton. They traded Roberto Alomar in that big deal for Fred McGriff. Those are three Hall of Famers that would have been on their team, you know, for their entire career if they had just stayed pat. You would have had an outfield of Winfield in right, McReynolds in center, and Gwynn would have played left. He never would have played right field.
Yep, that's absolutely right.
And then add the John Crux, who McCann traded away, Sandy Alomar Jr., Benito Santiago eventually walked, Carlos Baerga, who went to Cleveland in the Sandy Alomar trade. It's mind-boggling the amount of talent. Ozzie Guillen in the Lamar Hoyt trade. I mean, it's mind-boggling the amount of talent that McCann let slip through his fingers, and later, you know, Joe McElvain with the Alomar trade that really changed the course of the whole Padre history.
Yeah, because there was a lot of young talent at that time. I mean, I distinctly remember that, and it was rather frustrating. I was always able to understand the Alomar deal because you kind of had the two catchers at the same time, and I think they got Carter out of that deal from Cleveland, but you know then they spun around a year later and they flipped Carter with Alomar, which probably, I mean, that's McElvain. That was probably in my opinion, the worst trade the Padre organization ever made.
Well, and again, you know, Carter and Alomar became the core of the Blue Jays teams that won the World Series in 92 and 93. And Tony Fernandez, who went to the Padres in that four-player trade, wound up back with Toronto again and played on the 93 team that won the World Series.
Yep.
I mean, it's just craziness. You know, the only deal that really worked out for them, and nobody really knew it at the time, because Randy Smith, who replaced McElvain, was a sale for it, was the value-for-value trade that they traded Gary Sheffield to Florida and wound up getting a little-known pitcher named Trevor Hoffman in that deal. And I think that deal wound up working out pretty good. Worked out for Miami because they won the World Series with Sheffield and a host of other guys in 97. And obviously, you know, Hoppy is going to wind up in the Hall of Fame.
Right. Well, let's go back to 1984, because, you know, here you are, you've basically been there 2 years, and you must have been stunned. It's like, here you are, a writer, you come in, and here's this club, the Padres, have never really done anything, and all of a sudden, 84, and, you know, here it all comes together. What are your memories of the 84 season as the writer for the Union Tribune?
Well, I was the Tribune's writer, because at the time, we had two separate and distinct papers.
That's right, because the morning and the night.
Right, the Union was the morning paper, the Tribune was the afternoon paper, and we were, we were kind of Helen Copley's black sheep paper. You know, we could do pretty much whatever we wanted, while the Union really had to toe the line, especially politically and with business interests in the town. But they kind of let us go. And they wanted us to really stir it up. And as a PM paper at the time, it's a foreign concept these days because, you know, there was no internet, there was no cable TV, ESPN really didn't exist. So you got all your news from the papers or TV and radio. And basically in San Diego, generally, TV just copied the papers. They didn't do much of their own reporting.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, my job, I was hired at the Union Tribune actually to cover the Clippers. And by mid my first full season with the Clippers, my boss at the time, Tom Cushman, who was great, he was a tremendous columnist and he was a sports editor. And we went out to Bullies in Mission Valley after covering a Clipper Laker game, and you know, we were sitting at the bar, and he asked me if I'd ever covered baseball. And I go, "Well, you hired me. You saw the clips. You know I covered baseball." So he goes, "Well, how would you like to like be the backup guy on the Padres this summer once we're done with the Clipper season?" Because they weren't happy with the beat guy, a guy named Bill Worthing, It was Williams' first year in 1982. Williams basically, his gambit was to intimidate everybody. The pitch, the players, the coaches, certainly the media covering the team. And, you know, Wording didn't really want to have any part of him. So basically, Cushman told me, we want you to go in there and stir it up. And, you know, when Williams says something, go to the players, run it by the players. And it was sort of like, well, you got the perfect guy to do it. Cushman was from Philly. I was from New York. You know, we'd all grown up. And he'd worked for a paper, the Daily News in Philly, that was an expert at doing this. And he basically, you know, they brought him in, and the paper hierarchy wanted this to be a more controversial paper to sell afternoon papers. So, you know, I got into it with Williams, and I didn't care. And I look back on it years later, and I laughed. You know, I was like 32 years old. It was my first full summer, or part summer on the baseball beat. After, you know, I freelanced in my first 5 years in San Francisco while I got my master's at San Francisco State in Communications. And, you know, but this was my first real taste of this, and going toe-to-toe with a guy like that. And in retrospect, I looked at it and I said, I can't believe how much chutzpah I had, you know, to go toe-to-toe and tell Dick Williams what he should do. You know, and so, you know, we were just at war with each other all the time. And McKeon was, you know, he stirred it up. McKeon was probably the most Macedonian guy I've ever met in baseball. He was always worried about something else, or, you know, moving into a different position, or diving somebody in the back. And I always said that if he had spent as much time on his job as he did on all this extracurricular stuff, he would have been a tremendous general manager.
Yes, I totally agree.
But that was who Jack was, and Williams and McKeon never got off from the get-go. And so really, you know, the first 84 was my first full year on the beat after the half year of stirring it up. And, you know, it was just toe-to-toe every day. So, I mean, really, I always say, when people ask me about that year, as you did, that that team had the most miserable season I've ever seen for a team that was in first place for most of the season. I mean, that team was in first place after the Beanpole War in Atlanta, which was unconscionable. They were up by 10 games from like August 10th on. They just skied it, and there was so much trouble between the players and Williams. Now, Williams kicked me out of his office at one point because he didn't like what I was writing, and he told the other two guys who were covering the team, the late great Phil Collier of the Union and Steve Dolan, who was working for the Times now at San Diego State in a PR position. He told them that if any of his quotes got into my stories from them, they'd be kicked out of his office too. And then the players engineered a 24-1 vote to oust me from the locker room, with Steve Garvey being the only one voting for me, saying, you know, I don't like what he writes sometimes either, but he has his constitutional right to do it. So, and the players never really liked Garvey. So this was what I was putting up with. We had the John Birchers that year, you know, with Thurman, Trevecki, and Schau, and the controversy between those guys and the black players, Templeton and Wiggins on the team. You know, Wiggins was always in trouble with drug use. I don't know that he was never out of trouble with that. And, you know, and the team had no starting pitching. The starting pitching was so bad that in the middle of the season, you know, Williams, I've never seen this before, and we probably won't ever see it again. You know, he took the whole bullpen and moved it into the starting rotation, and moved part of the starting rotation into the bullpen.
Yeah, because he had to flip. I mean, we had no ace. I mean, I remember this, and that's a fascinating thing about that time is, you know, we had no ace. We had no real solid pitching, and I mean, that, of course, that really came into play later when we got into the series.
Well, you look at the, you know, I don't remember them off the top of my head, but that the numbers for the playoffs and the World Series were astronomical. And, you know, they only had one win out of the starting pitcher in the 10 games.
Yep.
Ed Whitson and King 3 in San Diego when they started their comeback. But, you know, saying all that, you always had the youthful exuberance of Gwynn on that team. And he and Alan Wiggins were on base something like 400 times together in the top two spots in the order. And Garvey was coming back off of a dislocated thumb that ended his consecutive game playing streak in 83. And he never really could swing the bat with the authority he did. I think he's hit 7 or 8 homers all year, drove in 70 runs. He was batting third behind those guys. You have four guys on 400 times and you get 70 RBIs. It's a pretty bad year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, everybody sort of like saved their best for that playoff series against the Cubs. You know, and Garvey's 5 for 5, with the game winning homer, 5 RBIs in game 4 against the Cubs, for my money, is still the greatest game of any single player in San Diego sports history. Not just baseball history, San Diego sports history. And the game-winning home run is still the greatest moment, in my mind, in San Diego sports history.
I thoroughly agree. I was watching on a black-and-white TV in my room. I guess I was 18 when it happened. It's just still to this day, I can still remember Garvey taking that pitch by Smith and just crushing it over the right center field wall, the short wall. And it's just still, it's unbelievable to me to this day to look back and think about that, because it was phenomenal. And it's not something we're used to in San Diego.
No, and a funny story about that. It was a Saturday night, and you know, the Tribune didn't have a Sunday paper. You know, we just published Monday through Saturday, and the Union had a combined circulation Sunday, so we never wrote for the Sunday paper.
Huh.
And with the home run that Garvey hit, you know, Trisha and I practically jumped out of our seats when we watched that thing go out, and then the next minute we looked at each other and we knew we couldn't write. It was unbelievable. And same thing happened with the Kirk Gibson home run up in L.A. too.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, some great moments because of the PM cycle in baseball history that I was at. I really couldn't write about because I had no paper.
That's fascinating. The great thing is at least you were there to physically witness it, and in that aspect it's awesome. But to not be able to write it, I can't even.
And you know, another thing about that era was that when the Union broke a story, and I could say didn't happen often when I covered both the Clippers and the Padres. Because I was really a very good news pound.
Uh-huh.
Their paper would come out at like 11 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm.
And if they broke a story, somebody on my desk would call me and say, "Did you see the Union? You know, they have blah, 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 blah."
Mm-hmm.
And I go, "No, okay." So I could spend a couple of hours, you know, hunting down that story and at least copying that story so that by the time the Tribune came out in its cycle, it started out at 5 o'clock in the morning, we had something of substance following that Union story in the paper. But the other way around was if the Union didn't have a story, and I did, they had to wait a whole cycle the next day to answer it, and we had a scoop for the entire day. I mean, now to these days, scoops don't last any more than like 5 seconds on Twitter.
Well, that's interesting because that's a question I actually wanted to ask you later, and I'll ask you now about it. Is how do you perceive sports writing has changed since the time you got started, and how has social media and bloggers changed the face of baseball reporting?
Well, you know, I don't think sports, if you do it the right way, I don't think sports writing has changed that much. And I think the training that I had as a PM afternoon paper writer really prepared me for this era, because you have to give people something, some substance. I mean, you got to figure that there were days where I was covering an afternoon game at Shea Stadium that started at 9:30 in the morning. And that story wasn't going to be published in the paper until 5 o'clock in the afternoon out in San Diego the next day. So I couldn't give a rehash of what happened in that, or write a game story.
Mm-hmm.
I had to come up with some sort of substantive story that people were going to, whether it was a feature, a news story, you know, somebody popping off, I had to come up with that kind of story every day because of that cycle. And the same thing mostly at home. So what I would do is, you know, I'd wait out the AM writers, and then I'd have the locker room for myself because I had no deadline until 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'd just get whatever I needed, and I'd have a good cohesive story in the paper the next day. I was always thinking ahead,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that was the trick of it. And so, you know, that's really how you have to, in the internet, it's really what you have to do today. Because everybody knows through Twitter and Facebook and whatever in the social media, TV, obviously, everybody knows who wants to follow a game, knows what happened in that game before you even, you know, put your fingers on a keyboard.
Right.
And so you really have to, like, have something of substance to write about that gives people an inside look or an inside edge that you're telling them something that they didn't see somewhere else. And to this day, I like, they try to herd reporters around, PR people, there's this herd mentality now,
mm-hmm.
especially in the National Hockey League. I mean, they limit the amount of people that come into the club, into the locker room after the game. They don't let you move and talk to people on your own. They tried to do that somewhat in baseball, but they can't get away with it right now. We'll see what happens in the new collective bargaining agreement and how much new restrictions come in place for the writers. Yeah, but I think that's coming. But I'm always going against the flow, or I'm always waiting out somebody because I'm still in a situation where, you know, now I have no deadline. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, whenever I will get what I want, if I have something, a story in mind that I want to have done, I just wait out the guy to come out of the locker room. I mean, a good example last year was the Giants were playing here at Chase Field against the Diamondbacks, and Bruce Bochy had just told Ryan Vogelsong they were putting him back into the bullpen because one of their guys, PV or Hudson or somebody, came back and replaced it in the starting rotation after the All-Star game. So as it turns out, it's an extra inning game, and who comes into the game in the 13th inning? It's Vogelsong, and he winds up being the winning pitcher. Now, he hadn't talked to anybody about the demotion, but he made it very plain that he didn't want to talk to anybody in the locker room after the game either. So he waited and waited and waited out all the San Francisco writers and everybody through their cycles, and finally came out with like 5 minutes to go for the second bus, and guess who's waiting for him? Me.
Yep.
So I got my story with Vogelsong. I mean, it's just, you know, the things that you do if you really want to have a good substantive story for people to read.
And I appreciate your writing. I mean, you are probably the one guy that I definitely, along with Rebecca, will read. And I also have to say,
that's nice of you.
And I really love how you handle people. And I'm speaking on Facebook primarily with this. I like how you handle people that haven't read what you've written but have commented on what you wrote.
Yeah, specifically.
Well, there's just in general, I mean, there's times where I'm trying to think, I can't remember a specific offhand, to be honest, but there's a tendency with people where they will either, you know, some people just like a story that they'll see, but then you can write about, say, Vogelsong, and then somebody will comment about Vogelsong, but you can tell that they haven't read what you've written. And you've always had a tendency to really let people have it if they haven't read your stuff. And it's something I've really appreciated you doing, and Rebecca has as well.
I'll put a note in it. Yeah, it's in the story. Why don't you go do me a favor and read it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I like that, because it's like, you know, people, that's a tendency with people to make a comment, and it's like, why don't you go read it? Vogelsong got put in the bullpen. That's what he said, you know. And people, and you know, I get a kick out of that with you.
Well, I also try to do it as nicely as possible, and you know, I'm very cognizant of the fact that emails, tweets, Facebook posts, you know, can be taken the wrong way.
Right.
And, you know, I have early on my Twitter account, I basically laid down the law with people and said, you know, you can disagree with me and we'll have a nice talk about it. But if you start getting pejorative, and especially if you curse, I'm blocking you and that's it.
Right.
And very early on, I really was able to filter my whole Twitter account, where the people who were on it and the people who were on Facebook, they're, you know, we have great conversations and we argue with each other, but it's never nasty.
No, I think that's
I think that's very important, because I'm just not going to put up with the trolling stuff that goes on those sites.
Yeah, and there's a lot of it. I mean, we've experienced that with Padres 360 and on Twitter, and it's just especially Twitter, because I think Twitter myself tends to be very sewerish if you let a lot of people in, and that might offend some people that are hearing this right now. But you know, there's a lot of people out there that will say absolute crap and just say the most offensive things just to be mean, and it's just, you know, life's too short to really spend time with people that are just going to be like that.
Right. I mean, it came up in the presidential campaign, because, you know, I've noticed this, and, you know, Bill Clinton said yesterday that, you know, he's tired of, you know, the Bernie Sanders followers essentially shouting down or denigrating the Hillary followers, and I don't see it happening the other way.
Right.
I love Bernie, but I'm a Hillary follower, and I'm going to vote for Hillary unless something dramatically changes. But I would never shout any Bernie Sanders supporter down.
Right.
I mean, I have a constructive conversation with that person about how why he or she has decided to make that vote. But I would never be angry or pejorative about it. You want to have more people inclusive. You want everybody to be involved. The more people you have involved, and in my case, you know, I look at it as, you know, I worked for MLB. I support MLB. I'm building my own brand, and I really feel like I want people to be satisfied when they talk to me or read my stuff, whether they agree with me or not.
Right.
I'll just say, hey, look, this guy is a decent guy. He didn't shout me down or tell me I was an idiot, and we had a great talk about it. And actually, in the Hall of Fame voting, which is the stuff that makes people the angriest, I mean, I've had some good conversations with people online, and, you know, one guy convinced me that, you know, I was wrong about Jeff Bagwell, and, you know, I reanalyzed it, and the next year I voted for him. And every year he puts up a little thing saying, you know, this at Boobski, great. I mean, he listens to people, and he's still voting for Bagwell, you know, my compliment. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of the things you want.
And I firmly agree with that. Well, let me talk to you a little bit about your book. You signed the copy that I bought of Bleep, and I'm really fascinated. I've been reading it, about two-thirds of the way done, and it fascinates me that you picked Larry Boa to write about. And I'm just curious, what inspired you, or what even made you consider to write about Boa as a manager during that time?
Okay. I did not pick Larry Boa. Larry Boa picked me.
Okay.
And here's the story. At that time, John Feinstein, a good old friend of mine, had written this diary of Bobby Knight his season on the road with the Indiana University team, and it was a huge bestseller. And a company in Chicago who had followed the end of Bo's career wanted to try and mimic that and do the same thing and do kind of a diary of Bo's first season. So they asked Bo if he wanted to do the book. And am I allowed to curse on your protest?
You feel free. Go ahead.
Okay, so, you know, Bo called me and asked me if I wanted to do the book. And I said, sure. He goes, I said, that would be great. And he said, yeah, I was asking around to find out who would be the best guy to cover it, because I'm an asshole, and I need somebody who's an asshole just like me to write this book, and I heard you were that asshole.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Oh, that's how that book came about.
Geez, that's a wonderful compliment for you, just to hear, hey, guess what? Yeah, we're both a couple assholes. What do you think? Well, gee, I never thought about myself that way. I'll leave it to Larry Boa. Well, what was it like writing it, you know, writing that book? I mean, I'll tell you, I remember, gosh, that's a lean couple years in Padre baseball. Because that World Series team got partially old. The Hoy trade didn't work out. Wiggins is on cocaine, you know, and I mean, he's dealt out of town to Baltimore. And, you know, and of course, the only constant's Gwynn. And, you know, of course, that's still just, rolling along, because Gwynn was just such a hitting machine and such a great person and player. And that, I tip my hat to you, because that's a period of time that I sort of want to forget as a Padre fan, and just the fact that you were able to sit down and write about it, to me, amazes me.
Well, I mean, the thing about Larry is that he gave you a constant copy, whether you're writing for the daily or writing for the long term, like this book. And you know, every day you'd have something going on with him, especially with the veteran players and even some of the younger players on the team who just didn't get along with them. So there was always constant fodder. I mean, you know, we always knew that you had to go back into Larry's office two or three times to talk to him, because he would get himself worked up, and by the third time, then he would just spew. It's another something that's gone in today's coverage of the game, where, you know, you have a press conference with the manager afterwards, and, you know, once he's done with it, and it's usually on the local RSN, as it is in San Diego on Fox, and then he disappears into his office, which is off limits, and there's no place to even come in and sit down and shoot the bull with him anymore. So there is no second or third wave with the manager anymore. It would be a much tougher book to write now than it was back then.
Huh.
So, you know, in saying that, you know, we never had the pregame scrums either with the manager. I don't think that started until maybe the late 90s, early, you know, I remember Joe Torre doing it in New York before Yankee games. That seems to be my first recognition of it.
Mm.
But, you know, Dick Williams, if you asked him to do a pregame, he would have told you to go to hell, and, you know, he wouldn't have wanted to talk to Dick Williams before a game. But funny story, though. I mean, I'm in there with Bud Black in the dugout a couple of years ago, and this young girl, is opening day starter is Jason Marquis. And this girl asks him, Jason Marquis has the propensity, and I don't think she used the word propensity, I'm using it, but the propensity to throw too many pitches out of the strike zone. He has a high percentage of balls. Have you talked to him about that? And Black's reaction was, yes, in fact, as soon as I'm done with these interviews, I'm going to go back there and talk to him. Okay, and it was sarcastic, and it was right, perfectly done. It went back to a Dick Williams thing. Kid in a game early on in the 83 season, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
He had Ron Eichelberger pitching.
Oh, I remember Padre,
we're at the Padres open, had the bases loaded at the bottom of the second, and Eichelberger came up to bat. He went out, they didn't score, and I'm not sure whether they wound up losing the game or not. But a kid asked Dick, did you think about pinch hitting for Juan Eichelberg in that bases loaded situation? And Dick looked up at him, and he always had this big cup of Chivas Regal in front of him that he'd sip while he was talking to us. And he said, get the F out of my office. I never want to see your face again. So I told that story. So after the breakup of this whole thing with Bud, I tell Bud this story, and he's just laughing his butt off. And he goes, can you imagine if I said something like that to that little girl? And I go, yeah, it would be all over the internet, and, you know, immediately all, you know, on Twitter. And you would be, by the end of the game, you would be telling everybody that you decided to go spend more time with your family.
Yeah. And it's funny because there are times where I know that I've heard press conferences with managers after the game, and I'm speaking of the Padres, and they get asked questions where, and I sit there just as a fan, and I've talked about this with Rebecca, and it's just like, I can't believe these guys can keep their composure. And that's funny to hear with Dick Williams. I would so empathize to be asked, do you want to pinch hit for Eichelberger in the second inning? It's like, are you really?
Yeah.
It is. Do you have no? Do you have no thought to the game? Honest thought to the game? Well, let's. I got a couple more questions, and I'm gonna wrap up with you, and I want to thank you once again for your time. Let's talk about Padres coming into the season. And I know that last year, you know, a lot of high expectations. They make a lot of moves, and you know, it doesn't work out. A lot of Padre fans are wanting, you know, everybody traded away, which is something you and I had discussed actually on Facebook at one point, and some things where you encouraged me to have a different thought, which I've definitely taken. What are your thoughts of the offseason moves with the Padres and the direction that they're currently going?
I'm not sure what direction they're going, really. From the moment last year when they fired Bud, and they were, I think, a game under 500 or two games under
500. It was one game under 500.
And two games out of first place, right?
Yeah.
And if Jock Peterson doesn't make that tremendous catch on Justin Upton the night before, the Padres are basically right there. And they probably wouldn't have been able to fire Bud that day. But from that point on, I've kind of just lost the Padres. I really have. I mean, I just never thought Murphy was a great decision to bring him in as a manager. I liked Murphy a lot. I just never really thought he got much of a chance.
I firmly agree.
It was an all-in last year to try and win. And I applaud ownership because I think they, and I wrote this on opening day, I mean, they had to make the Padres relevant again.
Mm-hmm.
After years of fallow, you know, baseball, which had alienated a lot of the fan base.
Right.
And they succeeded in doing that with the trades that they made and the decisions that they made. And you're essentially talking about, you know, their attendance, I think, went up by about 300,000, and it would have been even greater if they had a better season.
Right.
So, I mean, I thought they were part of the way there, but after watching them, even before Bud was fired, you could tell that the new guys, I thought, you know, Camp, Morris, Upton, Shields, certainly, I thought they all contributed well. Everybody had their... Camp had a bad month of May. Maybe Shields didn't win as many games as everybody thought he would. But what I love about Shields is that he's really a number two, a number three pitcher. But he has an incredible tenacity. You know, when he gets himself in trouble, he doesn't collapse like some of the other guys on the staff do.
Right.
And I just found it intolerable after a while, you know, watching Kennedy and Despaigne and You know, you go down the list, Kashner, even Ross was horrible. He really was underperforming. And then you had, you know, the injury to Kennedy on opening day. So you had Desfarnier in the rotation for the whole first month of the season. Then by the time Kennedy came back, you lost Morrow for the rest of the season. He may have been your best overall pitcher in the month of May.
Right.
And then by the time, you know, you're getting everything together, you lose Myers for most of the season with that wrist injury. And so, you know, the team was never really solid up the middle, you know, with Myers at center and Amarista and Jerko at short and second. And then when Middlebrooks didn't work out at third, then Solarte, great guy, but that left him play half a year with the Yankees until the Yankees traded him for Headley, the Headley deal, and he just can't play third base. Mm. He can hit it, but, you know, he's just not a very good infielder. So, I mean, when your infield is those three guys, and then, you know, you have injuries at first base the whole season. I mean, it was lucky that they were where they were in June. But you could see it and say, okay, you did half a rebuild, now finish the job. And that's why I applauded them at the trade deadline, that even though they explored the market on getting rid of a lot of their key guys, they didn't do it because I wanted them to keep the core together.
Right.
But when the offseason came and they immediately got rid of Benoit and Kimbrel, you know, it's like another fire sale, and they're looking at the amount of money that they're spending, and they're just not prepared at this point to finish the job. So right. I just think that's where they are. You know, they're caught in between what they did last year and what they didn't do this year. And you've got a very anxious, I think, ownership. You know, the ball club's a sieve. I mean, I saw it for years with John Moores. Nobody realized that John Moores put $20 million a year of his own money into that team when it was a good team.
Right.
And then when he got tired of it and he started losing money in his software businesses, and then, of course, the divorce with Becky, you know, he just stopped doing it and stop subsidizing the team. But it doesn't matter what the television contract is going to be. It doesn't matter what the circumstances are going to be. The Padres are always going to be in this position behind the eight ball in their market. Mm. Because there's only so many places for you to go. I mean, you have, you know, Mexico to the south, and they've tried to mine that to no avail. You have the Pacific Ocean to the west, you have the mountains to the east, you have Camp Pendleton to the north, and it's a very tough market to be able to make money in, and when ownership realizes that it has to subsidize the team on a yearly basis, you know, they just get tired of it, no matter what the subsidy is. I mean, even in the winter years, they were subsidizing it by, there were cash calls that were like $2 or $3 million, and the 15 owners from the San Diego, the 14 owners from 13 owners from San Diego, just didn't want to take money out of their pockets all the time. And so, you know, you got through the strike in 94, 95, and then, you know, Morse bought the team. And in the early going, you know, I never saw a guy with, who enjoyed being an owner as much as him. It was like this incredible season ticket. He loved coming to the ballpark every day. He loved being part of it. He loved the fight for Petco Park, to build Petco Park. I mean, it's just where they are. I just don't see how they can keep up with the Dodgers and the Giants. And, you know, the Diamondbacks are this year's Padres.
Right.
I mean, they've got, you know, they went out and spent all this money on Greinke. And they made the trade for Miller for number two, but they really don't have much of a 3-4-5. They don't have much of an infield. They don't have, their catching isn't strong. They've got two offensive players, or terrific players, Pollock and Goldschmidt. They've got the Cuban kid, Tomas, out in right field, who the jury's still out on what that long-term deal, whether or not that's ever going to bear fruition. It certainly didn't last year. And it's just tough for those. It's a two-tiered division.
Yeah, it is.
It's very tough. It's very tough for those three teams. You know, Rockies and it will seem to have completely given up. And, you know, to really compete with the Dodgers and the Giants. And I told Preller when I met him, and we were in Arizona at Padres series, and I went over and I introduced myself. And, you know, I like Preller a lot. I think he's a really bright guy. And I think he'll do what it takes to win if he's given the chance to do it.
I agree.
But we spent the first 20 minutes of this conversation with him asking me questions, not me asking him.
Uh-huh.
And especially among the young general managers in baseball who really believe that they know everything and are trying to reinvent the game. It was the first time ever in my career that a general manager had sat there asking questions about me. And his question was, what would you do if you were the general manager? What would the first thing you would do? And, you know, I gave him the recitation about the geographics that I just gave you, which, you know, basically is something that every Padre ownership from C. Arnold Smith all the way through these guys, the Seidlers and Fowler, have had to deal with and doesn't change. And the fact is that none of them have ever just dug in and said, okay, we're going to build this thing from the ground up and develop a farm system that is really going to be up there with the better farm systems that the Giants and the Cardinals. I mean, you know, these are teams, the Giants and the Cardinals, who can spend money, but they still believe that the building blocks of their system are the guys that they bring up through their own organization, and then they build around them.
Yeah.
And the Padres have to do the same thing.
That is going to have to be the goal.
Right, and, you know, as I said, when you go back and you say there hasn't been one significant Padres first-round draft choice since Kevin McReynolds, I mean, really? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Even Moore said that his one regret when he sold the team was that he really never developed the farm system. And he had the opportunity to do it, but he wanted to shell the money out on the major league level and not take the time, didn't have the patience to take the time to do it on a bi-level basis. You have to do it on a bi-level basis.
Yeah.
So Beller said to him, so in 5 years, if I come back to you and we've developed a system, are you going to be happy with what we did? And I go, yeah, I'm not saying that you can't win games on the major league level and develop on the major league level at the same time, but unless you build that foundation, which this ball club has never had, this franchise has never had, you're never going to be able to get ahead of the eight ball in San Diego.
Right.
And then the first thing they did was go out and, you know, bankrupt the minor league system to, you know, for the quick fix on trying to make the team relevant again. And, you know, they tried and it didn't work. And now all those prospects are gone and you have to start all over again. And, you know, the franchise has really been set back for a while.
Well, and the only thing we can hope is that, you know, really honestly, Preller knows what he's doing. And also, you know, and this is my fear, you know, so many fans want him fired, they're mad. And, you know, we're going to have to leave a guy there for a while and let him build a foundation and let him see whether or not he can draft guys and put together a system. Because, I mean, you've really touched on it. Padres really haven't had a solid minor league foundation in a very long time, if really ever. And the only way we're going to compete is if we get guys that we have here for 5 or 6 years that we can control, and then we keep a couple of them, and maybe a couple we let go, but we continue to go ahead and build through the system, and maybe bring a guy
right
in from the outside and supplement.
Yeah, you have to constantly churn people out of the system. You know, really, if you look at the Giants, while they were, you know, last year's of Bond in 05, 06, 07, you know, they were constantly trying to build around Barry with aging free agents to try and make the team win. And when that didn't work, they wound up with pretty good draft choices, and they wound up, you know, getting Posey and Lincecum and Kane And, you know, really, Crawford, I mean, you rebuild, you build a system where to the point is you have a total infield from your catcher around to third base that came up through your system. Most of your starting pitching over the last few years, not this year, because they put in Samardzija and Cueto to replace some of those guys, but, you know, your starting pitching core came out of the system, your bullpen came out of the system, and if you need to go out and get a Scudero or a Ross or a Pence or, you know, somebody at the trade deadline, Beltran 1 year, it didn't work out, but I mean, yeah, that's what they do, but yeah. They build around the core, and the Cardinals do essentially the same thing. And so the Dodgers have to do this to be able to move forward, or else they're going to always be stuck in this cycle where, you know, they just can't get over the hump. They can do it every once in a while, but you know, but now you're talking about, you know, it was 59-84 before they went to the World Series, 84-98. And now you're talking about, you're getting on to almost 20 years since the Padres were in the World Series.
Yeah.
You know, and other organizations like, you know, Kansas City, the Mets, you know, the Marlins, the Diamondbacks, you know, they've won and you haven't. And so, you know, you really have to look at it. And, you know, there are not too many teams in baseball or all of sports that really know what they're doing and do it the right way. And baseball, I'd say there's a handful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the top of mine are the Yankees and the Giants. And the Yankees are just a megalopolis. I mean, you know, there's so much involved with the Yankee organization. You know, their tentacles go so far into the city of New York in terms of their catering and building and the soccer team. And, you know, they fitted out the tower on the new World Trade Center building. I mean, there's so much more that baseball is a core product, but it's only part of the product. And they do a pretty good job of keeping it relevant year in and year out, even when you got through the core four and core five era. You know, and the Giants are just this era. I told friends in San Diego last year, if I were general manager of the Padres, what I would do is I would look at the Giants, and I would do everything that they do from a business standpoint and a baseball operation standpoint and just let it all fall into place because they all do it the right way.
Yep, and
I
firmly agree with you. And I think Kansas City has sort of replicated that same type of page with what they've done over the last few years as well.
Well, we'll see, you know, Kansas City, you know, we'll see if they're, you know, once they go through this era, whether they're going to be able to sustain it, and if they can sustain it over, you know, 6, 7, 8 year period of time, then it'll be one thing.
Right.
You know, if they can't, then, you know, we don't know that's moving forward. But, you know, right now we do know that, you know, the Giants went to the World Series in 02 and should have won, barely lost. They had the whole Bonds era, good or bad, whatever you want it, and, you know, the center of the universe from pretty much 2003 to 2007 was San Francisco. And then when Bonds left, they had a year or two of rebuilding, and they've been, you know, in the thick of it and have won three World Series since 2010. That's a pretty long period of time of success.
It is. And it's a quality organization. It honestly is. I'm not a big Giants fan, but I say this. I definitely respect them, and I respect what they've done in every capacity. Really good organization.
And the one thing the Padres have is, just like the Giants have AT&T Park, that little jewel,
mm-hmm.
You know, the Padres have got Petco, which, to my money, is probably a better facility than AT&T. It doesn't have the views and the water. It's not, you know, situated in that direction to be able to do that. It's not close enough, as, you know, that is, which it's right on the bay in the Covey Cove. But as far as the footprint of AT&T to the footprint of Petco, there's a much more spacious ballpark. The egress and ingress is much better. It's a great place to watch a game, the way they cantilevered it with the upper deck being closer to the field. I mean, you know, the designers and John and, you know, Larry Lucchino for a while, Eric Judson was involved in it and still works for JMI, and they really did it right for the long term. When you look at it and with the improvements that they've made, the ballpark doesn't look 10 years old. It looks like it was just built.
Mm-hmm.
So they have that, and it's become a destination just like San Francisco for tourists. People come to town in the summer, and they want to go to a game at Petco Park.
Yep.
Now the thing is, their challenge is to put a great product in there that equals the ballpark, just like that was the Giants' challenge, and they spent the whole 90s getting there, starting with Bonds and ending with 93 and then adding to that core, and they made the playoffs, and then they went into the new ballpark, and it really hit it from that point on. And that's the challenge that Padres have. And for fans, the fans of San Diego just drive me crazy. I mean, last year, I fended off for the first few months of the season and all the naysayers and boo birds and everything about Bud, who, for my money, did a great job, you know, with what he had over the course of time there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he went through like three club ownerships, you know, a number of general managers.
Like four GMs.
He was the mainstay there.
And I will always believe, and I'll wrap it with this, I've always believed that the Padres did Bud Black dirty. And if anybody doesn't like what I just said, then they can stick it.
Well, and so, they had a guy there who they could build around. They decided, you know, that, and I think the fans put a lot of pressure on ownership.
Well, they did.
To create the atmosphere. And you always can create an atmosphere where a person is going to get fired. And that atmosphere became created, and it began with the fact that they didn't extend out Bud's contract, and they left him as a lame duck manager going into the season.
Yep.
So anytime anything went wrong, that was going to be the question, as it always is in those situations. And, the situation was such that, as he moved forward, and they blew up Brendan Murphy, that I think most San Diego fans realized that probably wasn't Bud's fault.
I agree, and it wasn't. And honestly, we should have let Bud just finish what he had started. He had always been a better second half manager because we've always had turnover, and you know, a good manager, you just don't walk on the field and people immediately win. You know, Bud had to spend year after year with different guys coming in and going ahead and constructing a new team and trying to get these guys play together. And that's not, you know, it's not fantasy baseball the guys are, these managers are doing. This is reality. These are real people.
Yeah.
You know,
especially with the disparate personalities that they brought in last year, that he did a very good job, you know, managing and controlling.
Yeah.
But moving forward on it, my whole point was that if the fans are now getting on AJ in the same manner, fire AJ and bring in somebody else again, you know, if they're going to go through the same thing. Because you can't go from Towers to Hoyer to Josh to, you know, AJ Preller in such a short period of time.
Right.
And expect that you're going to have any continuity or that things are going to be any better for the long term.
Right. And I firmly agree with you. And with that, I really want to thank you for your time. And I want to keep you on just for a minute afterward, wherever, just to wrap it up. But Barry Bloom, thank you for your time. And if fans want to get a hold of you, on what's your Twitter handle?
Well, I'm the national columnist for NLP.com, so you can always get my stuff there. That's the mainstay. My Twitter is at Bloomsky, BLOMSKIE. And, Facebook, just Barry and Bloom. So there we go.
Thank you very much, Barry, and you have a great night.
Thanks, Wayne. Really enjoyed it.
Okay.